Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the broadcast. I am super excited for our conversation today. Since the very beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, we've seen an outpouring of interest on the part of data scientists and AI practitioners wanting to make a contribution. At the same time, some of the resulting efforts have been criticized for promoting the spread of misinformation or just being disconnected from the applicable domain knowledge. The question that we're here to address today is, how can data scientists get involved and do so in a responsible manner? And I've got a great panel lined up to help us do that. Before we dive in, a couple of housekeeping notes. We really, really want to ensure that this is an interactive discussion. So your comments, whether you're viewing on YouTube, Facebook, or Twitter, are visible to me, and I'll relay them to our panel. And it's really my sincere hope that you will help drive a good part of the discussion today. Next, this is the first of many discussions that we'll be bringing you on a wide range of topics. To be notified when we schedule future discussions, please just follow or subscribe to us on whatever channel you are watching right now. Before introducing our panelists, I'd like to send a shout out to our friends at IBM for their huge support of what we're doing here at TWIML generally and this discussion in particular. IBM has been at the forefront of the fight against coronavirus. Through their leadership in the COVID-19 High Performance Computing Consortium, they've helped bring together the federal government and industry and academic leaders in support of COVID-19 research. In addition, they're bringing together trusted data from governments, the World Health Organization, and the CDC to provide detailed virus tracking on the Weather Channel. And they're offering free access to Watson Assistant to respond to common COVID-19 related questions. For more information on these resources and links to dig in deeper, as well as to learn how you can get 30 days of free Coursera access when you join the IBM data science community, visit the resource page for this program, twimlai.com/RDSCOVID. With that said, I am really excited to introduce myself and our panelists for this discussion. I'm Sam Charrington, founder of TWIML and host of the TWIML AI podcast. Rex Douglas is a computational social scientist and director of the Machine Learning for Social Science Lab, MSSL, at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at the University of San Diego. Hi, Rex.
Howdy.
Rex's research focuses on applying advanced technologies to research problems in the social sciences and policy world, particularly on issues of human conflict. Rob Monroe is a former guest of the podcast and a longtime friend of the show. He's currently CEO of Machine Learning Consulting. Hi, Rob.
Hey, everyone.
Rob has extensive experience in crowdsourced data, disaster response, and the intersection of these areas. Leah Shanley is a senior fellow with the Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she focuses on open science, innovation strategy, and policy, responsible AI and data ethics, and expanding diversity in data science. Welcome, Leah. And Gigi Yuan Reed is a distinguished engineer and executive responsible for data science innovations in the healthcare space at IBM, with an emphasis on the use of predictive models in clinical applications. Hi, Gigi. All righty. So let's jump right in and get started with a round of questions so that we can get to know our panelists a little bit better. We'll start with you, Rex. You recently wrote an interesting piece on how to be curious instead of contrarian about COVID-19, 8 data science lessons from a coronavirus perspective. Without necessarily going into the specific lessons that you present in that article, we'll come back to those. Tell us a little bit about the origin of that article and what prompted you to write it and how that relates to your work at MSSL.
Sure. So the big idea is that my note is ostensibly a takedown of a specific piece that Richard Epstein wrote posted to Hoover, where he predicted only 500 deaths in the U.S. and made a long list of other false and sophist arguments. In reality, though, my note is a Trojan horse intended to try to sneak some basic social science research design methods to a broader audience who may not otherwise receive that kind of information. I wanted to show by example that these kind of gatekeeping or lane-keeping arguments are themselves another kind of anti-intellectualism. I argue that during a crisis, it's exactly when we should be encouraging people to become more curious and more scientifically rigorous. Right now, a good chunk of the planet actually wants to know about causal inference and about confidence intervals and about Bayes' rule. And for God's sakes, we should be telling them, especially before theaters reopen.
Awesome. Rob, a lot of your perspective on this issue comes from your experience working in disaster response. Share with us a little bit about your background in this area and the concerns that it raises for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've worked as a disaster responder for about 20 years, for about the same time that I've been working as a data scientist. And in every major disaster that I've responded to, I've seen people die as a result of people cutting corners, including actions taken by well-meaning data scientists, often grabbing media attention when experts should have had that attention. But like I've also said, I think some of the biggest impact I've had is not when I've been working in refugee camps or directly for disaster response. Some of the biggest impact I've had has been when I've been at large companies. So I ran AWS's NLP service for a while, Amazon Comprehend. And it's when I've been working with large companies like that and getting them to expand into more languages and think about general ways that tools can be adapted to different parts of the world. I think that that's built a foundational layer that I'm seeing right now. A lot of people responding to COVID using. So I'd love to share on this panel some of the ways that you can take your existing skills as data scientists and help plug gaps in the COVID response.
Awesome. Leah, much of your work, including co-founding citizenscience.gov, has focused on encouraging everyday citizens to get involved in science and help accelerate innovations in this country. My guess is that scientists don't always welcome the input of the quote unquote unwashed masses. Can you share a little bit about your experience in this area?
Well, like Rob, I've worked at the intersection and served as a connector between the academic research community, the tech innovation community, crowdsourcers, citizen scientists, and disaster management practitioners. Like Rob, over the last 10 years, we saw a lot of enthusiasm and well-meaning, open data scientists, and others try to contribute and innovate in the middle of a crisis, but they lacked an understanding of what the disaster response community actually needed on the ground. And so, we tried to work to build that bridge between the practitioners, the research community, and the digital volunteers. For citizen science and crowdsourcing, yes. One of the first questions we get when we propose crowdsourcing or citizen science approaches is, what about data quality? And that field has become rather mature, and there are a lot of great approaches now for assuring the data quality levels that you need for a project, just as you would with any scientific research or data analysis.
Awesome. And Gigi, your work at IBM involves what you describe as translational science. So translating between cutting edge machine learning and AI research and making that accessible and scalable to your customer and end users. Can you share a little bit about your experience coming from the clinical informatics side of things and how that applies to COVID?
Yeah, very interesting time. I think based on my experience in trying to take cutting edge technologies to our end users, sometimes a very sophisticated clinician or a consumer who's trying to understand the risk for the health program. Thinking through that, really, really drive home the need for transparency. I think Leah and Rez and Rob, you all kind of touch upon that, right? The fact that we got to be transparent, not only on the data and its quality, but the assumptions that we can use. I think that tends to get overlooked by the end user, and it is our responsibility to make sure we work with the domain experts to validate those assumptions. So that's kind of the biggest piece that I'm advocating. I do think data science, that's a lot we can do, even to overcome the issues of data security, privacy, and how to leverage the streaming data from IoT. I think that's a lot we can contribute on. It's a matter of how do we strike the right balance.
So once again, I want to remind our viewers to contribute questions via the chat. We will incorporate those into the conversation. But I'd like to start out really exploring the idea of, you know, what's at stake when data scientists get involved, and talk through your examples of, you know, where you've seen help, where you've seen harm, and what folks are really worried about when, you know, they kind of push out their arms and say, hey, data scientists shouldn't really, you know, be involved in this without working with domain experts, whether that be epidemiologists, virologists, what have you. I'll let you start with this, Rob, and then we'll, you know, incorporate others.
Sure, happy to. So first out, this isn't new. It's not new that we're seeing data scientists step into to disaster response efforts. And we have a lot of past examples already where there have been very negative effects. So I'll give three examples. I also presented all three of these at the KDD conference last year, one of the largest data science conferences. So these should already be part of the dialogue that people are having around data scientists responding to disasters. You know, this is not something new. And if you haven't read the papers and the dangers in the past, you should think carefully about the kind of work that you're undertaking. So one of the biggest negative impacts I've seen was during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Having worked in epidemic tracking and having lived in West Africa in the past, I did a lot of work advising on this. And one of the biggest causes for unneeded deaths were data scientists in the West coming up with really like doomsday prediction models about how bad Ebola could be. And so the people who were going on the big media programs during the Ebola outbreak, they weren't the professional epidemiologists. These were data scientists from adjacent fields, and the media just eats up this story like this could kill us all. So as a result of the international pressure from the media, fueled by people who did not have that expertise, but who looked like they were experts, there was a lot of misinformation, a lot of people being too scared. And so we calculated that for every person who died from Ebola in West Africa, 10 more people died from treatable illnesses because they were avoiding hospitals and clinics unnecessarily. So this was a very clear example of where so many people died because of misinformation that started from well-meaning non-experts. Some of the others relate to open data and data security, like people have mentioned already. So when I was helping respond to the previous coronavirus outbreaks, the SARS-CoV-1 or MERS, we found that because a lot of these outbreaks were in countries where the rule of law is very different to the West, people going in with different assumptions. So, for example, Saudi Arabia wanted to find people in social media who were reporting the actual numbers of patients in hospitals that might have differed from the official government numbers. And we evaluated this at that time and decided that even if this project was well-meaning and even if it only used open data from people's public tweets, these people could be seen as disagreeing with the government and could be persecuted as a result. And so we decided not to go forward with this particular project. And then the last of three examples, also working in the Middle East during the uprising in Libya when Gaddafi was overthrown, I was helping the UN track displaced people. So it seems like a use case that should just be very non-controversial, like who's internally displaced or a refugee in another country and needs help. But people within the region saw the UN's involvement as being a Western involvement. And our security was compromised, and some people treated as collaborators with a Western invader, not as people helping humanitarian efforts. And again, this was like set up by data scientists who didn't have a background in disaster response, like technologists who thought they could do good, and ultimately did far more harm than good. So those are three very negative examples. I'll pass it over to the other panelists here. I do want to assure everyone watching though that I do have a lot of good examples of ways that people are helping and can help that I want to come back to.
I want to second Rob's comments. We saw the same thing in working the disaster space, curation of social media for, you know, who needs medical care, who needs water, who needs rescue, et cetera. And it's not just in other countries. It's here in the U.S. We're seeing retaliations against certain vulnerable populations. So while we espouse open data, I think we need to be careful and, as Gigi mentioned, ensure the privacy and security, particularly around vulnerable populations.
Yeah, and this conversation reminds me of it's about 6 months ago, right? Where there is a commonly used population health analytics to help stratify individuals for intervention, right, to prevent hospital readmission, where that work was built upon a national data set, right, to understand individuals' health risk. But what was overlooked is the fact that the training data set was biased. Like, certain demographics tend to have richer data than others. Mm-hmm. The mathematics were great. The sensitivity, specificity were high quality. Unfortunately, that's a piece of like data bias that we overlook. And that's a piece that we should really think through, right? Because the pandemic is really evolving very quickly. Every local county has very different data completion, right, and data coverage. So as data scientists, I think it's our responsibility to really think hard about what is the data that we bring into our models and being very hyper-localized, right? What are the strengths and weaknesses of different data? If you don't keep that in mind and have the discipline to do the bias and diversity check at the end, we could really further advance the imbalance in healthcare.
So I think it's those are some great examples, Rob, and it's clear, I think, to everyone that the stakes are high. I'm curious for you, Rex, based on a conversation from a comment you made in our earlier conversation. You know, when a lot of people, you know, see these kinds of, you know, or think of these kinds of potential harms, you know, the immediate reaction is, well, if you don't have a epidemiology degree or a virology degree, you shouldn't be involved. You should, you know, take a backseat to, you know, the experts. You know, you're a data scientist who is involved in this work, but you don't have a degree in epidemiology or a background in disaster response. You know, how does that, you know, occur for you? And, you know, how have you reacted to those that kind of commentary?
So the way I tried to lay out the piece was to make an argument that the difference between good work and bad work is not your level of expertise in that field or the strength of the quality of your priors. I define science as a curiosity about the true state of the world and the application of evidence and methods to form truer beliefs than we held yesterday. And that holds for every level of skill and every kind of question or form of empirical inquiry we could form. And there are parts about COVID that the experts don't understand currently. There are things we'd like to know about what's going to happen in the future that almost no one understands, and these are probabilistic forecasts. There are smaller things that individuals would like to understand, like of the expert recommendations, which ones should I follow? What happens when they contradict each other? What assumptions are the models making, and are they getting better or worse over time? How do I be a smarter consumer of expert information? And I don't know a single scientist, no matter what field they're in, who isn't climbing up the walls right now trying to understand this global pandemic and how it affects them, how it affects their family, what they can contribute or better understand themselves. And so my big takeaway is that we're not going to be able to prevent bad work through gatekeeping. The people who are doing bad work before COVID are doing bad work now and will do bad work in the future. What we can try to do is we can try to encourage people to be curious and methodologically rigorous, and then keep giving them concrete examples and feedback to positively support them on that journey as they move up the curve.
Hey, earlier, you brought up a couple of examples of, you know, even the so-called experts, the epidemiologists, credentialed epidemiologists, publishing studies that were later shown to be, you know, later taken down. Can you mention a couple of those?
Sure. So there's a really good paper called Learning as We Go, which does sensitivity analysis on that IHME, Institute for Health and Metrics Evaluation forecast. that is an example of a credentialed group, according to the Lane keepers, who's producing the most culturally dominant forecast in the U.S. right now. But their 95% confidence intervals are right only about 27% of the time. And their accuracy doesn't improve when you shorten the time horizon for their predictions. And if you actually eyeball the confidence intervals, they get more confident the further out in time they go. And there's all sorts of problems with their model and all sorts of weird assumptions. But this kind of picking apart someone else's work if you have a background in statistics or causal inference or research design, anyone with that training can start to see the pieces and understand the underlying problems and maybe contribute some feedback and some review that will help others in picking between models. Just because they were first to the pitch, or they were able to culturally position themselves as the most influential forecast, doesn't mean that they're the only forecast within epidemiology, and it doesn't mean that we should just accept them because they're credentialed.
So we had a really interesting question come in via the chat. David Clement is referring to the peer review process that, you know, we've historically used in academic publications to ensure the quality of research. You know, what's the role of peer review, and why or why isn't it helping in this environment?
I can speak to that briefly. So peer review is absolutely helping in this environment. In many disasters in the past, which came on much faster than COVID, there was no advantage in cutting the corners of science. So the science itself couldn't be rushed. What can be sped up is the review process itself. And so this is something that I have seen different in COVID to previous disasters, I think because it is so global, that a lot of major publications are speeding up this process and letting it be open. So for example, at the largest computational linguistics conference, ACL, which is coming up, there's now a workshop specifically focused on COVID. It's open review. So it's allowing itself to be the right place for these kinds of discussions to happen. And papers are being reviewed on a rolling basis, so as quickly as possible, as soon as they're being submitted. So we've been able to really speed up a process that, you know, might have taken 9 months waiting for the right conference to come around in the past, and bring it down to a couple of weeks without cutting corners on the science itself. So it's been great to see that across a lot of different disciplines at the moment.
And Leah, when you've worked to scale up these kinds of citizen science efforts, have you incorporated, or what kind of review processes or checks and balances or peer review have you been able to incorporate into those kind of programs?
Well, with citizen science, you would go through the same kind of peer review that you would with any scientific research if the intent is to do scientific research versus, say, strictly education. So you would still, you know, produce published papers that go through the normal peer review process. And in fact, these days, a lot of citizen science projects are including the citizen scientist as co-authors on those papers. And in some open peer review process, you know, people can contribute to the peer review as well. I want to tag on, though, to Rob's comment about, you know, a lot of this preprints of the research is being made available and speeding up the peer review. The White House has issued a call to action to the tech community. The publishers have made the literature now openly available around COVID. They've made a team of different organizations have gotten together, including Microsoft, the National Library of Medicine, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, to make those articles machine readable. So they now have 29,000 scholarly articles on COVID that are machine readable. The White House now would like the data science community to develop text and data mining techniques to help speed up, you know, synthesizing these materials. Mm-hmm. And they are also provided a set of research questions to help guide some of that. And that is available on Kaggle.
So Ayodele gets us to our core question, you know, what can data scientists do to help? And she's specifically asking for resources, but I think there's a lot to dig into just on, you know, what are things that data scientists need to be thinking about when they're considering getting involved? Rob, do you want to get us started on that one?
Yeah, sure. I can go through a laundry list of things which are really important and for which there are very little negative consequences. There's a lot of ways that you can jump in and help without potentially endangering people. So content moderation is huge. If you work at a large company doing content moderation, or if you want to take one of the existing open data sets, that's really important. So obviously there's a big NLP component to it. But also computer vision. So for example, a lot of even the bigger companies right now can't do matching on a fake news image if it's cropped slightly differently or it's like in envelope format, et cetera. So there's some low-hanging fruit there that already exists in open data sets that any research would help us. Unfortunately, during any disaster, while crime goes down in general, some particularly nasty people ramp up in scams and exploitation, especially exploitation of minors. So again, if you're working in content moderation or content health, and you're able to identify scam artists or people looking to exploit children, that's incredibly important right now. And again, there's some existing initiatives for that. Any work in low resource languages is really valuable right now. So the majority of calls that I've had with organizations like WHO have been especially worried about how to get information out, how to start using natural language processing in low resource languages. They're not captured in any of the large libraries that we have. Some of the existing open source data sets that I've helped create for disaster response have low resource languages. So any research into those would be valuable. You see them in AI for All. Some Stanford and MIT classes have used them. Udacity's Nano Degree in Data Science uses a data set that I created too. Any of that research would be valuable. And then there's just like a ton of things around the edges. Like cleaning data is always valuable. Like, I mean, if you turned up to volunteer at your local hospital, you're not going to be invited in to do surgery. But you might be given a mop and bucket. Expect the same thing. If you turn up to
good analogy,
yeah. So if you turn up to a big organization, they're not going to be sitting there with a well-structured data set ready to go, and they just need 10 lines of PyTorch. But data cleaning is really important. Sanitation in a hospital is equally as important. Especially at the moment. That's how I started out for years, just doing all the grunt work in disaster response. And it's a very noble and valuable way to start. The last example, anything around supply and logistics. So there is no world database of who has what kinds of medical supplies. And a lot of the world governments are now implementing really like basic crawlers and machine learning systems to work out who has a supply of medical masks or respirators and things like this. And in almost any disaster response, the supplies and logistics component of it ends up being the biggest part of it, the most complicated part. And there's a ton of machine learning in supply chains and logistics. But not enough, because it hasn't been a popular area for people to research. And again, like any research in this area would be really valuable for those of us in disaster response.
Anthony Garland asks, what's the role of IoT devices in this pandemic? He's speaking specifically about personal IoT devices and health trackers like Fitbit. But Gigi, I'm wondering, either personal or kind of within hospitals and healthcare systems, other IoT use cases, are there interesting opportunities for data scientists that arise in the intersection of COVID and IoT?
There's, I mean, two aspects to it, right? In terms of personal IoT device, right? One is there's a lot of interest around better understanding of social distancing adherence, right? Are people actually following the orders or guidelines by the local government? So the personal IoT device has rich data to support that. But of course, we've got to be vigilant with the security and privacy. But we are seeing there's a strong correlation to adherence to some of the disease curves, right? So I think that's an area that will be of interest. Another area will be to help support some of the symptom checks, right? As opposed to trying to get on a phone call and talk to someone and understand their symptoms and putting it in the CDC website. There's a lot of opportunities in leveraging the data that's being collected in these personal fitness devices to help supplement that. Mm-hmm. Like think about, the fever monitoring devices. Think about, especially for one of the high-risk group is folks with hypertension and diabetes. Right? Think about those IoT devices, how they can be incorporated to help detect people at high risk. So,
and Trace Together is another one where they're looking at the connectivity as who's exposed to whom, and but doing it in a privacy way that secures people's privacy, but alerts them if they've been exposed potentially to people who've been diagnosed.
Yeah, that's a great one. In fact, I just had a ethics conversation internally in IBM how to handle that. As you, some of you may have seen in the latest White House guidance, there's a point to ask employer to support their employees' contact tracing. So if you and I have gone to work, And the next day, we should be alerted by our employer if someone else on my floor has been tested positive for COVID. So how do we do that while protecting the individual privacy, the insurability?
So Rob, you took on that question of how can data scientists help from a use case perspective. You know, Rex, maybe you can take it on from a practices perspective.
Sure. There's two big ways that at least our shop is trying to contribute, and I think are low-hanging fruit and opportunities for other people in this space. The first is in the aggregation of existing data. Not just cleaning, but munging different data sources together creates a lot of problems. And my shop, day-to-day, we're a knowledge graph shop that works on aggregating conflict panel data or political science data measured across countries or localities. And so when COVID counts started coming out of confirmed deaths, number of tests, it looked just like the data we were working with already. And so we've rapidly been prototyping a system to aggregate all of the COVID data globally at least a province or state level and preferably below. So we're up to about 300,000 observations, a couple dozen data sets. And doing that kind of work is something I think any data science shop can contribute to. The other one is evaluation of models and predictions. If there's anything ML people know how to do, it's how to create a test set and take a split. And I just want to do a shout out for one project I know of. Nicholas Reich's lab at UMass Amherst has been collecting the predictions and forecasts from different groups, normalizing them, putting them into the same sheet, and then seeing how they perform over time and even creating an ensemble prediction based on all of them. And that is something we can immediately start trying to do is evaluate and combine the forecasts we have already. And the faster we do that, the more informed decisions we'll be able to make in the next couple months about reopening in the US or other places.
Any other takes on that? Things that data scientists need to be thinking about when they're considering jumping in and helping out?
Listening to the panelists, right? Two things come to mind. I think, Rob, your earlier point about NLP. In addition to helping with clinical and genomic discovery, right, looking at the various literature, that there is a strong desire to better understand local government's policy. It's changing on a daily basis. In order for us, you know, to build robust models, we had to look across geography while really being careful about local differences. So if we could spend more time enabling policy insights to the NLP, it could be very valuable.
GovLab did kind of a rapid assessment of different topic areas that could be looked at and proposed at least 12 areas going beyond tracking disease spread and a supply chain of the PPE to protecting human rights and promoting accountability, you know, oversight of governments and their actions with COVID, alleviating pandemic-related unemployment and poverty, education and upskilling, identifying which businesses may be at most risk, and helping inform policymakers of that as they make their decisions. And as we talked together in the pre-planning meeting, identifying and tracking misinformation.
So misinformation is, didn't come up in specifically in talking about some of the potential harms, but it's kind of the backdrop of a lot of the, you know, angst that comes up in this conversation. You know, any specific examples of misinformation or disinformation relating to COVID that any of you have seen?
Yeah, I've seen a lot related to, I guess, basically what you could call folk remedies, and that's in every country in the world. So whether it's something with no known benefits like homeopathy here in the United States, or other local remedies in other parts of the world. This happens in every disaster and in every disease outbreak. It can be very dangerous when that misinformation relates to poisonous things. So as soon as we introduce something like bleach as a cleaning agent in any disaster, we know some percent of people are going to drink it. As what happened with, I think it was chloroquine or certainly some other quinine derivative here, where people drank it who didn't even observe symptoms and people died. You know, often on the back of well-meaning people, people who think there are solutions or there are types of protective measures which they believe are way better or way worse than they truly are. And this becomes the biggest worry for us when celebrities get behind it, because no public health organization can compete, you know, with a Hollywood celebrity with tens of millions of followers on social media. So it gets really tough for us when a lot of these celebrities will double down, you know, maybe on remedies that they have a financial stake in, like that stupid goo product. And so that's where we see like a lot of the danger, because, you know, we can't compete with those kinds of people in social media. And a lot of them are being kicked off social media. YouTube and Facebook especially have been great at this. But it's always trailing. The damage has often been done by the time this content gets removed.
I think they also thought that 5G was causing coronavirus. So people were burning down the 5G towers. There's an organization, NewsGuard, which has a misinformation tracker around COVID. And I think the Credibility Coalition and the MisinfoCon folks are also have efforts in this regard. Mm.
Yeah, so I think as a data scientist, this is one area where you can use your critical judgment. Similar to what Rex was saying earlier, you know what a good report versus a bad report looks like. You should be able to evaluate objectively whether a public official has experience in this area, whether they're calling on peer-reviewed articles when they present their evidence, versus someone who's sharing their anecdotal experience. And as the data scientist in your family, you probably have a better critical thinking capacity than most other people. And so helping your family become better critical thinkers and how to evaluate any advice skeptically and choose the best advice when there's conflicting advice, that's a really valuable thing that you can do in your community.
There's also a big need for data scientists in this research space. So when I ran one of the big data innovation hubs for the National Science Foundation, we had a community of 100 researchers, data scientists, digital anthropologists, political scientists, all bringing to bear their different disciplines to understand, track, and develop mitigation strategies for misinformation.
You know, I would like to comment too. Sometimes the information is true, but it's not applicable to your situation. I think that's the piece that I tend to see often. For instance, right, we hear how a lot of local hospitals are having resource shortage, right? Patients have to be turned away, or there's been a call to ask non-critical or elective surgeries to take a pause, right? And it really depends on the local health system. And we are seeing that there are acute conditions that shouldn't have gone down are going down in areas. Like there are less heart attack, there's less asthma attack, and there's less trauma cases. And in some sense, it could make sense because people are not traveling as much, but the rate of decrease is a little alarming. Right, so hospital resource shortage doesn't apply to your local area. I think that's, you know, we got to help our community think through that. It's true, perhaps in one city, it's still true for where I live and where my families are.
We started off talking about examples of the potential harms, but what about specific examples of where data science is helping out and making an impact? Leah, you had a few.
There are lots of different opportunities, I think, for data scientists and other data-related folks to plug in very positive ways. I think in our discussions we talk about you not only need the data science at the table, but you need the epidemiologists, the virologists, the immunologists, economists, and other kinds of professionals. So there's several opportunities where they're bringing these kind of teams of folks together. MIT COVID Challenge is one where they're looking at innovating using data and other approaches for solutions in Africa. The DevPost Global Hackathon is another place. We'll provide those links afterwards. They've got, I think, something like 18,000 people signed up to contribute. The U.S. Digital Response team, which is started by some former White House Deputy Chief Technology Officers, has now got over 4,000 volunteers, and they're pairing those data science, back-end engineers, product managers with local government folks to help, you know, build websites, things that are free, open source, and extensible or replicable to other locations. And then in the citizen science space, we've got Folding at Home, which is using distributed computing. So if you want to, like, study at home, you know, donate your computing resources to help solve some of the medical challenges around COVID. There's the coronavirus binder design game, which is developed by Foldit. So we've got serious gamers figuring out how a protein related to coronavirus works and figuring out how they might disrupt that protein. Eterna is another one of these online series games that requires some complex problem solving that having a data scientist help probably would be helpful. And then, you know, as I think Gigi mentioned, it's there's not just COVID we have to worry about, but now we've got some fabulous air quality, right? So doing things like monitoring air quality, doing things like monitoring water quality, it's Earth Day. And, you know, how is this impact of COVID on our environment? There's a big opportunity for folks with IoT skills, data science skills, Earth observation, geospatial mapping to help with those efforts too.
Other examples of where data scientists, you know, non-epidemiologists, virologists are jumping in and adding value?
So no one's mentioned kind of the efforts from journalism, and a lot of newspapers have data scientists on staff now. So I just wanted to point out that the main source of tracking for testing in the U.S. is the COVID Tracking Project, which came out of an effort by the Atlantic and two journalists. Mm-hmm. In India, COVID-19 India is a massive crowdsourced effort. If you go on GitHub, you can go country name by country name and find at least one, you know, data scientist or beginner who has started scraping the local health ministry website and getting unstructured data into a structured form that we can then use. Mm-hmm. I think one of the main comparisons here is not between epidemiologists and scientific experts and civilians or data scientists or amateurs. It's between government resources and capabilities and the civilian capital, social capital to work on that. So if the New York Times is the one who's putting together county level counts of COVID in the U.S. and not the federal government, that tells you something, right? New York Times and Reuters are both tracking that at the county level, because there isn't a strong federal system with reporting all the way up the chain and all the way down the chain. It's newspapers collating this information for us. And so we have to step in where the institutions fall short, and that can only be done by regular people.
David Clement asked another really interesting question about how the role of data science shifts as this pandemic continues. You know, early efforts have been involved in modeling and dashboards and the like, but what does the role of data science need to evolve to as time goes on? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I can speak to some part of it. I certainly can't speak for all of data science and how it can respond. One of the most constant things I'm seeing working with really large organizations doing public health and misinformation is the areas where we can get help from data scientists. So almost all the systems I'm looking at don't have much data to begin with, and they need to bootstrap from not many examples. So human in the loop systems, smart active learning, adapting to low resource languages with inconsistent spellings and more complicated suffixes and prefixes. Lots of really important problems that just aren't part of what most data scientists learn. Most data scientists will learn about purely automated methods where the data is constant, and the data is never constant in disaster response. So again, a lot of the things that might look useful for multilingual NLP, like zero-shot learning, really aren't that useful. Zero-shot learning requires a fairly large unsupervised, unchanging corpus, and the percentage difference doesn't change a whole lot. What we need more is people who can think about the productization, human-in-the-loop systems, where it's the human, either expert or non-expert, for example, giving medical advice, who can look up a database of maybe the right answers and give that advice. And so this is one of the areas that I've been given advice to. So a lot of major companies working in this area have been introduced to a lot of data scientists. So data scientists at all the big tech companies are willing to step up and do the right work. But they're getting introduced to the wrong people. They're getting introduced to someone who can do a cutting edge paper in zero shot or one shot learning. Whereas actually the data scientists who probably have the best knowledge, they work in content moderation, or they help out with customer success for customer service systems. So I think a lot of that human computer interaction side of data science, which I find really fascinating. I think that becomes way more useful in a disaster response environment, and I would love to see more people picking that up.
Gigi, I think you had something to add to this one.
Yeah, I was smiling because less on the technology aspect, but as we think through the use cases, as many countries are trying to figure how to recover and get back to the new normal, I think we have to think through, like, care delivery will not be the same anymore, right? Half of the care today in America is delivered through telemedicine. And I think that statistics may even be higher than that. What can we do as data scientists to help improve not only monitoring, but the experience between the clinician and the patient as they are no longer able to physically touch, right? So the signs of haptics can come in, the signs of how we share and transmit monitoring data, all that comes in. And another impact that a lot of us wear is as a teacher, right? As an educator, we'll be delivering our education material in a very different way. How can we make that more interactive? And how can we learn from, imagine the data that we're collecting in this online system. How can we learn from that and really provide a much more rich experience for our students? So my mind actually went in a way of, okay, in a new normal, not only in health, but in many, many disciplines, there are a lot of opportunities for us.
Yeah, the idea of the new normal is an interesting one. I saw an article the other day that talked about how in Milan, they're taking advantage of the change in the traffic situation in the core city to implement some pro-cycling measures. So they're going to be reducing the vehicular traffic in the city core and adding bike lanes and things like that. And the new normal is going to be new, and it will provide a lot of opportunities for folks to jump in and help with the kind of modeling that they've done in non-epidemiology domains. So we've got a number of questions that have come in that relate to the kind of data that, you know, that we're seeing being published by media and experts talking about. I think a lot of these questions are getting at kind of the couple of things, a lack of confidence on the part of the information consumer as in terms of what media we can trust, as well as the rapidity with which viewpoints are changing. We've got folks showing data on different sides of, you know, the utility of masks and the position that local governments and organizations like WHO CDC is shifting over time. We've got similar types of data on different sides of social distancing. Any thoughts on like cutting through these differing perspectives? And more importantly, how do data scientists help their communities cut through these differing perspectives?
Well, I'd say be very wary of the media, for one. Most journalists are great people and they want to report things honestly, but media companies are not aligned with providing you the most important information that you need. A lot of media companies have the same narratives in every disaster, and it's that the responders aren't doing the right job. Why is this being ignored? Why did somebody cover this up? Why is there a conspiracy here? And even when journalists know that it's not a real story, it's part of the narrative they have to tell. And you can be smart about this. If you see stories come out and there's no author in a big publication, that they normally know that they're spreading misinformation, or they get an invited expert opinion who is no expert at all to say something outrageous. But it can be tough. Like Rex said, like some of the most useful sources of information have come from data scientists and journalists working together. I'll flag that there's a lot of variety, the media is tough to trust a lot of the time.
So you mentioned working with local communities. I had mentioned the U.S. Digital Response, which is working with local government, but there are other examples like the Data Science Federation in Southern California. That was started by Gene Holm, who's in the CIO's office at the City of Los Angeles. And they've partnered with 18 universities and organizations in the area. So the students and faculty and staff are working closely with the city. You know, students and faculty and the other volunteers bring the data science expertise. The city brings the problem space, the use cases where they need that help. And that's kind of a local on the ground use case.
you know, I was listening to you, Rob, and I think, what do I do, right? What do I advise myself and my children to do when you're exposed to this different news channel and information? I think the first thing I go to, of course, the author and the citation. I think the second thing I'll advise folks to pay attention to is the metric. You can very quickly tell the thoughtfulness of the numbers behind the scene in how they report the metric, right? It's just the number of cases or number of cases per capita. That is a very simple example, but many, many, many ways you can ask you, if you focus on metrics that's being used and being reported, and you ask yourself, is this translatable? I think that is a good indicator for me.
A corollary is to look at the y-axis of the graph and whether the numbers are jumping around like some of the ones that we've seen going around.
There's been some interesting variations on log scales. I thought that was complicated.
I was about to say, check and see if there's a log scale and check the units, right? I mean, things that you learn in elementary school, it's very, very relevant.
Well, that there's even a scale. Like if there's not a scale in the first place, that's really good indication that there's something going on.
I think it's actually, if I could make one point, right? I think that's a piece that some of us could overlook ourselves, right? Especially coming into a new field, what is the right metric to use? What is the right scaling factor to use? We got to be thoughtful of that and coach folks we work with.
One quick point on this that I raise in my piece is that not just the media, but some of these political actors are producing speech that they know is wrong, or they're incurious about what the right answer is. They just have to produce a particular viewpoint. And their mistake here is to try to respond to that point for point. There's something called the Gish Gallop, which is it's a debating tactic where you just spam bad arguments as quickly as you can, because the time it takes to explain why those are wrong is longer than it takes to make the argument in the first place. And so we have a risk here where certain media or certain political actors are producing false speech at a rate faster than we could possibly debunk it. And frankly, if you're an expert in these fields, you shouldn't be spending your time debunking this. You should be producing work and getting us to the right answer independently. So the only response that I've found has either been through speech like comedy and satire, where The Daily Show used to take apart bad arguments for you in a very creative way quickly, or through positive education. We have to provide scientific literacy to our families and to our population so that they can tell a bad argument no matter which day or year or decade it's made in on what topic. That's getting it at the bud is the only way to protect them. It's like a vaccine against bullshit. And it's the only hope. Otherwise, you'll bankrupt yourself trying to go beat for beat with these people.
On the satire front, there was an article that was responding to another article that purported that public transportation was one of the key spreaders of the virus in New York City, based on correlation between, I forget what the specifics were when the city shut down and public transit usage or some random correlation. And the satirist, an author, basically took the same argument and article and rewrote it with the correlation being to bike sharing using the bike sharing data. Just poke fun at the argument. We're coming up to the top of the hour. I want to take another couple of audience questions to help us close out. So Megan asks a question referring to COVID-19 data sets, but brings up the broader issue of bias. And this relates to something that you opened up with, Gigi, as well as the idea of transparency. Can you speak a little bit to the importance of bias and transparency and things that we need to be thinking about, both generally and when dealing with these data sets?
Yes. Absolutely. Really being, I call it the gating requirement. It's first take a look at the completeness, coverage, and distribution of your data, right? And I think it's more than important, especially when we're dealing with public health situation, to consider the dimensions of not just demographic groups, but different local diversity sets. So I think that's the piece that we're very passionate about. And secondarily, I'll go beyond just the data set. I think it goes back to my earlier point about being transparent on the assumptions that we are making, it's amazing, right? If you look at an epidemiology model, if you include asymptomatic patient or if you don't include asymptomatic patient, you could get a 2 to 3 times differences in results. If you don't mention that to your reader, then I think we're not doing our job. So transparency in data and transparency in assumptions.
Any additional thoughts from our panel on bias and transparency or data sets?
Stay tuned. We're working on a piece called How to Be Careful with COVID Counts that's going to investigate that question exactly.
And if I could add one thing, right? It's interesting how we often report on cases and deaths as opposed to recoveries. It's also interesting how we don't report on testing availability and that being a driver of what we see in the results. So I think all of that, I look forward to the article.
Bernard asks, and this is a great question to help us wrap up, is there a responsible data science 101 out there that folks can go to and have a look at?
Start with the article I wrote about 5 ways that data scientists can help and 5 mistakes to avoid. There's a lot of links in there if you want to do deeper reading about things that worked and things that didn't work in the past too.
And Rex's article as well. And in fact, we'll link to all of these articles and other resources that have been mentioned in this conversation and that our panelists have to share on the program page for this, which is at twimlai.com/rdscovid. Matum asks about that term that you used, Rex, in the context of debating. We'll get that in there as well. But at this point, I'd like to thank all of our panel for participating in this great discussion. Thanks, everyone. All right, everyone. That's our show for today. To learn more about today's guest or the topics mentioned in this interview, visit twimlai.com. Of course, if you like what you hear on the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. Thanks so much for listening. And catch you next time.